I'm Julianne Good, and this is Psych 101. Welcome. We are here to make psychology more understandable with tips for you, your family, and your friends for making your lives easier. Welcome and Happy New Year. Happy 2015. I am really excited about the new year coming in. I have a feeling that events will turn. I think we're going to have a more positive year this year. The forecast is for more jobs on the market, which of course adds to our security level. So I'm really happy about that. Did you have a good New Year? I hope so. I hope it was safe and you were surrounded by people that you cared about and loved. That is the best way to bring the New Year in, isn't it? Well, tonight we are talking about parenting with Dr. Mary Ann Franco. And Dr. Franco, hello, how you doing?
Hi there, Julianne. Happy New Year to you as well.
Thank you. Did you have a good New Year?
Oh, I had a wonderful one. Thank you for asking.
Excellent. I'd like for you to tell the listening audience a little bit about your background.
Well, sure. I'm Dr. Franco. I have a private practice in Long Beach. My area of interest is, of course, you know, children, families, couples. I am also a board director and a clinical supervisor for a nonprofit organization. We specialize, Julianne, in the treatment of individuals and families who have been victims of abuse. So we provide home-based and school-based interventions, which have been really powerful, I believe. Aside from that, I do teach part-time for counseling psychology students who are in their master's and doctoral level. On the more private side, I'm a very happy wife, a very proud mother, and grandmother.
That's awesome. That is a lot to take on at one time. She's like a very busy woman.
Busy but happy, very happy. That's very balanced, I should add.
Yeah, that is important, isn't it?
Yes, that's always the goal.
Yes, it is.
Especially when you have multiple roles.
Yes, yes. One must keep everything in balance and tuned up. So, Dr. Franco, what do you think makes for a good parent?
A good parent is a combination of being nurturing, having your boundaries very, very set, having your needs met. We talk about being able to balance, you know, multiple roles and multiple tasks. Being a parent comes with a lot of immense responsibilities. Any parent could attest to that. However, you know, there's a magical side to it, too. But if you're not able to get your own needs met, the possibility of you being easily agitated, angry, and unable to become emotionally available and accessible to your children, you know, run really, really high. In other words, be a happy person, and most likely your child will be a happy child.
Right, because you will be modeling for that child.
Yes, whether you know it or not, whether you are aware of it or not, you become their primary role models. And, you know, Julianne, it goes further than that. The emotional atmosphere that the child, the infant, caregiver relationship has set becomes the tone later on in life, whether they're choosing romantic relationships or, you know, their choice of friends to hang out with, even the choice of superior supervisors and bosses that they become attracted to or become part of their lives.
Oh, that's interesting that you bring up that aspect. How would that play into what kind of a household you came from? What parenting that was displayed and then you as an adult with your supervisors and bosses?
You know, typically, if you have a parent who is unconditional, who is loving and validating, and who's very supportive of, you know, maybe your errors or your idiosyncrasies, you would most likely gravitate or attract individuals, not just your bosses, but friends, family members later on when you delve into the romantic arena, who would emulate, who would be very similar in their interactive style with you. Think about individuals who were victims of maybe violence, victims of domestic violence specifically. When you look at their histories, for the most part, it would always have an element of either observing some kind of abuse, whether it's physical abuse of a parent to a child, or whether it's being very, having parents who are extremely argumentative, high conflict, you know, have engaged in aggressive behaviors and hostility. Now, this becomes your neural template. This becomes your comfort zone, so to speak. So later on in life, when you navigate by yourself as an individual, as an adult, you captivate this kind of experiences. You naturally, for some reason, are attracted to them, whether you want it or not.
I kind of have a theory about that, Dr. Franco.
Tell me.
Yeah, I think in a situation like that where somehow you're going out and you're attracting, you know, the sort of personalities that your parents were, and you didn't really get along with your parents. But you're going out and you're attracting that as an adult, and you're thinking, why am I doing this? Why am I repeating this? I think a lot of it has to do, at least in my case, that these lessons present themselves, these people present themselves in your pathway so that you can learn from it. And what do you need to do now? What can you change? Why are you in control of now that you weren't in control of when you were a child? Because you don't have much control when you're a child. So I almost think it's a learning experience to have those people come into your path, as long as you can recognize that and then learn from the situation. And then sometimes that situation starts clearing itself out, and then you start clearing those types of people out. Or you start associating with those people less, because then you know what the red flags are.
You know, Julie, I completely agree with you. The opportunities for learning will present itself continuously until you no longer need that type of learning. And you see that, too. You see the growth, the evolution of individuals who have been victimized. You see that once they are able to internalize and really become focused and aware that they have sole responsibility, accountability, and decision-making for themselves as adults, then those experiences will no longer present itself. They'll move toward relationships that are more harmonious, that are more loving, that are more functional, and that are more life-affirming. And that's probably something that you've experienced as well.
Yes, and that was well stated, by the way.
Thank you, Julie.
That was very nice. So if you're coming from a household where your parents are not high functioning, what can you do when you're, let's say, a teenager? Because, you know, I mean, that's when it starts kicking in, that you can start making your own decisions and your executive thinking is starting to kick in.
As a teenager, you become exposed to other people as well, maybe the parents of your best friends, or maybe school staff, or some kind of mentor will hopefully come into your life and change that mindset that adults have this negative, conflictual, interactive style altogether, that there are people out there who will reverse that template for you, or who can at least help you do that. That's where therapy comes into play as well.
Mm-hmm.
Your therapist can be kind of a surrogate adult figure to you, who will provide you with that corrective emotional experience to help you through the healing process. Of course, the internal process needs to be in place to be able to get to a point where, you know, you can be the best you that you can possibly be.
Yeah, that's great. And it is important to be able to have other adults around who can serve as healthy role models. So anybody that a child or a teen can go to and just say, hey, you know, I've got some ideas, and I want to talk with somebody about this, and I just want somebody to just listen to me and give me healthy attention. I think that's really... that's a great thing to have in one's life. Wouldn't you agree?
I agree. I totally agree. It's a great gift, you know, of life when someone is able to, you know, be that alternative reality for you. Julie, if you look at statistics, if you look at studies, or even maybe in your own client load, for those individuals who are able to traverse the negative childhood experiences that they've had, the one common denominator that I have seen is that there was someone who intervened, someone powerful enough, usually a grandparent, a kind person, or a teacher, a mentor, or even a friend, or another family member, you know, who was able to impose a different kind of reality to this person, to this child, to this client.
Mm-hmm. And be nurturing and supportive.
Yes, to be unconditional as well. I think in today's society, everything is based on conditions. If you do this, then I'll do this for you. But the child needs something more than that. It needs to be appreciated for the unique person that he or she is.
Yes, definitely, definitely. So what would be a good start for being a conscious parent? Say if you know, a couple is pregnant and they're thinking, you know, well, you know, one or both of them came from dysfunctional family households and they want to change that pattern. Besides, you know, what the desire to change that, what else can they do to start putting that into play so that they can start becoming healthy parents and have healthy children, and, you know, the ball gets rolling and they get, you know, healthier generations as it goes along?
I love that question, Julie. Excellent question. The first thing that they can do is to get their own therapy. See where they would like to change. See what, identify what parenting styles they acquired, you know, through their parents. You only do what you know. And perhaps as a couple later on, when they are able to process the stuff, the emotional baggage that they each carried or carries, then they can, as a couple, identify, you know, what kind of vision they want for their child. They have to negotiate. It's best to negotiate ahead of time before the child is delivered. What kind of rules, what kind of consequences, what kind of rewards, what kind of tools you would like to apply when they become parents, mm-hmm. before the child arrives.
Yeah, so couples therapy, in other words.
Couples therapy, but also if there are specific barriers to becoming the parent that you want to be, you know how it is that most parents have the best intentions, but because of the negative histories that they themselves had, it's difficult for them to move forward and to progress. In these cases, individual therapy may also be very helpful because you need to be able to process your own stuff first. Otherwise, you'll naturally get the ball rolling and, as you said earlier, you'll just pass it on to the next generation and the next generation. And without intervention, we know that it'll keep on happening at least for three generations.
Oh, three generations.
Yes, three generations out.
Yeah, at least. Yeah.
At least, yes.
Yeah, you never know unless you sit there and question. And sometimes, you know, you just have to stop in your tracks when you're with your child and say, okay, is this true to my relationship with my child? Or is this something that I'm carrying on from my parents or grandparents? Am I going into autopilot here and not really thinking about what the consequences are if I behave in a negative way to my child?
Exactly. I mean, we learn from the best and the worst. If we had poor parenting, then we can make it a point, our intention, to fix it, to make it different. What I did, for example, with my daughter was that my mom and I had a very erratic relationship, and I always put in the forefront of my mind that whatever I wish my mom had done with me and for me, I would do with my child and for my child, and it worked out perfectly.
Yeah.
The negative experiences can always be used as a catalyst for better ones, better experiences.
Right, hopefully. Yeah, you just have to stop yourself in your tracks.
Yes.
Sometimes that's easier said than done, but then again, you know, I think too, the guilt and the shame kick in after you've done something negative with your child, like, you know, yelled at them too much, or, you know, some parents still do the spanking thing, and, you know, I mean, you have to look at the shame and the guilt afterwards, right? I, you know, that's where I think that process for change can come in.
And you know, Julie, that's a great opportunity when you need to be humble, when you have to humble yourself as a parent and say the words, I'm sorry. That's a very powerful message, a very powerful tool that they can use later on. It comes, what it conveys is that we're not always right. And when we're wrong, we know how to accept it.
Mm-hmm.
And we can humble ourselves. And the second part of it, too, is it goes back to what we talked about earlier, and that getting your needs met as an individual, as a parent, is very crucial. Otherwise, you'll inadvertently become more predisposed to being easily agitated, easily triggered by, you know, by a child. I mean, a child really is a demanding being.
Yeah, especially when they're between like 2 and 4 years old and they think they're ruling the universe.
Yes, they are your world.
Yeah, but that is a great point, Dr. Franco. Getting your needs met.
Getting your needs met, getting your emotional needs met, your social needs met. You don't use your child as a surrogate best friend. You don't tell them intimate details about your life. You treat them as a child because that's what they are. Because once this delineation is crossed, then that respect will be impacted in a negative way. You want to have those roles clearly defined for your child.
Yeah, and
so then the respect will always be there.
So how does the respect start withering down when that boundary's crossed?
Well, when the child thinks of you as more of their friend, more of an equal, then your capacity to implement rules and specific roles would very much be vague. You cannot tell them what to do if they're your friend. You're on equal footing. The power differential becomes so neutralized that the respect factor is neutralized as well. It's not to say that you don't treat them as a human being. You treat them as a child, just not your equal. And I think that's one of the biggest errors that we have in America, specifically in today's society, and it's that children are given so much freedom, so much capacity to decide, so much liberation without the accompanying sense of responsibility and accountability that must go with it. It's not optional. If you have this privilege, then this is your responsibility. And not because you're 18 means that you're an adult. It just means that you're 18, that you've reached the age of 18.
Right.
But if you're still living with your parents, for example, and still being supported by them, then those privileges don't necessarily have to come into play.
Right, and you should still respect your parents, period.
Yes, and most parents who are not respected by their child have not mirrored it, have not modeled it for their child, and so the child is not able to mirror it. And if they also witness their parents being disrespectful to each other, using words, using language that's, you know, very vile, then how else can they learn?
Exactly. Well, Dr. Franco, I would like to come back to that arena after we take a commercial break, okay?
Of course.
Are you searching for answers and insight to life issues? Is the behavior of family or friends questionable or concerning? Find tips and possible solutions from the convenience of your own PC, cell phone, or tablet at therapycable.com. Therapy Cable has the most comprehensive library of contemporary therapy videos online. Help may be as easy as a few clicks away. Therapy Cable offers comprehensive therapy videos ranging from addiction to self-care and contact information for qualified providers. Find the answers to your life challenges at therapycable.com.
And welcome back to Psych 101 with Julie Ann Good and Dr. Mary Ann Franco. And we were talking about parenting. And one of the things that we were talking about was just the boundary issues that a lot of children and parents seem to be going through now with the power differential you know, with the children having more freedom, maybe acting out in public without being reprimanded, without being disciplined. And that seems to be kind of a growing issue, wouldn't you say?
I would highly agree with you, Julianne. The one thing with boundary setting is that you first have to have it as a parent. You have to be able to set your boundaries for yourself. If a child, for example, sees you not being able to assert yourself, let's say with your boss, with your friends, you know, you're like a doormat, then it's very difficult to be able, if not impossible, to be able to implement that and pass it on to your children because you don't have it. You can only give what you have.
Yes, that's true. And would you say that there are some parents out there that are just afraid to discipline their child out in public because they think that other people are going to be looking at them and judging them, you know, wrong? Or do you think that's one of the problems?
You know, for one thing, a lot of parents are afraid of their children, period. And for those parents who are maybe ashamed of disciplining their children in public, well, the good news is that every parent knows that the child usually acts out in public because they know that the possibility of reprimand is less, which means that if you do reprimand your child in public, it's most likely going to be condoned more than a source of shame and ridicule for you as a parent.
So in other words, they know that they can get away with it. To a certain degree.
They can get away with it, so they will most likely engage in those behaviors in public. But again, you know, the secret to that, too, is being able to implement those rules at home, providing them with that solid foundation at home so that when they're in public or in other settings, across settings, they would behave in a congruent way, in a congruent manner, that it shouldn't be very different from one setting to the next.
Right. There should be this consistency.
Yes, and the rules have to be clearly established. The child has to know that this specific behavior will generate this specific consequence, either whether it's a reward or a punishment. And this has to be known to the child beforehand. A sense of predictability and structure really helps in terms of managing children's behaviors.
And then what do you say to parents when they tell you, oh, I'm too busy to have to sit down and implement all these rules and try to figure out what they're going to do before they do it? And because I've heard from some of the parents, oh, I'm just too busy. I don't want to have to take care of it. I just want them to behave.
Then if you're too busy, then these are the behaviors that you can expect from your child. You know, negative acting out behaviors, oppositionality, defiance. You know, there are all ways to get your attention. And if you're too busy, then think about what you would like to invest in. What are your priorities? Recalibrate. And if your child's behavior and well-being, not just their behaviors, but their well-being is not of prime importance, then this is what you should expect.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing more.
Yeah.
The therapist cannot do it by themselves. They
True.
Cannot do it alone. And it's funny you say that because a lot of parents come to therapy hoping that they can drop off their child, and then you, the therapist, wave their magic wand, and when they retrieve their child, it'll be a completely different one, the ideal child.
Yes, exactly. I know. Well, I think the thing that disturbs me is, for being a therapist, is just, you know, you have this beautiful child in front of me, and obviously the child is a sponge for what's going on at the household and secondary at the school and their neighborhood, but mostly from their household. And the parents are so frustrated. The teachers are frustrated. They just said, just fix them. Just fix them. Like you said, the magic wand. And, you know, it's got to be a team effort.
Absolutely. And the first thing I tell parents, Julianne, when they come to family session or the intake session, is that if you want your child to change, I have a surefire formula for that, and it is you have to change first. And if you're not willing to do the former, then the latter is not going to happen either.
Yep. So how do they react to that?
Well, some never return. They prefer a therapist with a magic wand. And some do put in the time and the effort, and they see the benefit. They see the dividend. I mean, when you think about it, the most important investment you have in this life, as you know it, are your children,
yes.
Is your child, if you have one. There's nothing more important than your child.
Yes.
Anything else you can purchase or anything else you can duplicate.
Yes.
But the child is yours alone. It's your responsibility.
Yeah, you're a parent forever.
Gift. Yes, yes. And it's not just your gift to that particular child, but it's the gift that you impart with the individuals, with the people whose lives are impacted by the child that you reared and mm-hmm. raised. It becomes a legacy.
So what do you say to parents who are bringing in their child who is seemingly very problematic, saying temper tantrums, maybe they're bullying or being bullied,
mm-hmm.
and they're angry and they're depressed and, you know, just a whole gamut of emotions going on with this child?
You know, one of the things I ask the parent, Julianne, is, how was the pregnancy like? And this, their narrative of how their pregnancy was like would really be able, it'll help you capture what's going on with this child. Because at that moment that the child is in vitro, it feels, it becomes a sponge, as you mentioned earlier, for so many emotions that are going on with this mother without the capacity to rule out or to filter any kind of feelings, any kind of thoughts that the mother is having. And the way that I feel problematic behaviors are approached in a child is rule out any biological conditions, any developmental delays, any kind of organic deficits that may be interfering, impacting the behaviors of a child.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, if a child's frontal lobe system has been impaired, damaged in some way, whether in vitro through substances perhaps, or through accidental means, then the capacity for the child to make positive decisions, to be able to think about long-term consequences, would be greatly, greatly diminished, if not decreased, if not diminished altogether.
Mm-hmm.
And you identify any kind of psychological variables that could play into the picture. For instance, any family history of mental illness, any kind of mood disorders, any kind of psychological factors that could be feeding into these behaviors, any kind of sociopathy, any kind of antisocial acts. For instance, if the parent is, you know, a serial killer, for example, then you have to perhaps consider and put in the equation that there may be some psychological reasons for the acting out behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
Then, of course, you get into the psychosocial and the social variable, school, what's going on at school. You know, are the administrators, the school staff, are they supportive of a positive learning environment for this child? And then you go into the friends, the peers that your child tends to gravitate toward. Are they also, you know, good influences, or are they more risk takers and those who engage in negative behaviors as well? So it becomes more of a group process for them. So there are several ways of identifying what's going on with this child. Are there internal elements, or are there external reasons that the child is acting out? Was there a death in the family, something significant that's happened that's interfering with his homeostasis?
So you really need to delve into multiple lines of history with a child.
Yes.
And
absolutely.
Hopefully, yes, hopefully the parent will be open to that process. I've interviewed parents before with, quote, problematic children. But it's interesting just doing the interview and asking them the questions, and then they start putting the pieces of the puzzle together, and then it starts making more sense to them as to what is contributing to their child's, their issues and their unhappiness.
Yes. You know, Julie, one of the most frequent reasons a child becomes the identified patient, so to speak, or the problematic person in the family is because couples who are not able to directly communicate with each other, the conflict, the disagreement, the negative energy that they have toward each other, but once if they present with a facade that's perfect, you know, picture perfect parents, and you've seen this, you know, with your friends or family members even, when the parents are not able to discuss their own matters, the negative energy typically becomes rerouted to this problematic child who mm-hmm. carries all the symptoms, all this negative acting out behaviors. And what usually happens, Julianne, is that when the parents finally are able to process their own stuff, the child's symptomatic behaviors are eliminated altogether, even without intervention.
It just kind of disappears because that energy has been lifted from the household and it's being directed into the area that's supposed to be.
Yes, the proper channel.
Right, versus the child sucking it all up and thinking, well, you know, I can do something about this, or, you know, maybe if I'm a better child, then my parents will get along. I think that that's a real common thought process in a household like that.
Exactly, and usually no one in the family is privy to this. Nobody knows about it, nobody's aware of it until you perhaps guide them in this direction and point it out to them. Usually this family will present itself as perfect, you know, someone who's admired by many of their friends and colleagues. But when you really dissect what's going on in the family, you will be able to identify that the parents have such a, you know, poor relationship. There's no intimacy. There's no loving connection. And so all this negativity is rerouted, displaced onto this poor child.
Yeah, and you're right, they are the symptom bearer sometime. And yeah, that's a heavy responsibility for a little one to take on.
It's a very, very heavy responsibility. And so I would suggest to, you know, for therapists, psychotherapists, family therapists, that when they see a perfect picture of family, to really tune in to what's going on, because there's so much left that is left unsaid, but you can see non-verbally what's going on in this family and really take the time to assess the family functioning, the dynamic, the rules, the roles, spoken and unspoken, that are going on within this family, and not just to blame this one child, the symptom bearer, for all that's going on, because that is the role he or she has assumed, has been given, has been assigned.
Exactly. And it's an odd power in itself to be that child. It's like, wow, look how I can make the household shift if I just walk into the house, right? Whether it's positive or negative, and probably most of the time it's going to be a negative shift.
Absolutely.
They walk into the household. You know, at least one of the parents is hollering at him or her.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's frightening sometimes, actually, to watch that shift happen.
That's true. I'm glad you brought out that point, the power that this child has.
Yeah, and the parents...
unwanted power.
Yeah, the unwanted power, exactly, Dr. Franco. That's a perfect way to state that. So we are going to take a music break, and we will be right back with Dr. Marianne Franco. nice tune. Hi, and welcome back to Psych 101. I thought I was just talking to Jenny, my board operator.
It is a nice song.
It was a nice song. I love it. Jenny picks out the greatest tunes for my show. I love her for it. She's just great. Wonderful, wonderful woman. So anyways, Dr. Franco, we were talking about parenting and we're talking about, just trying to get your household straightened out and not grow up in a dysfunctional household, not passing that on if you happen to have grown up in that type of household. So what kind of tools can you offer parents if they don't want to pass that negative energy on?
Again, first of all, Julie, they have to process their own stuff because otherwise they will inadvertently pass it on. It's a natural trajectory of life. Whatever you know, whatever you experience, you will most likely pass on without, you know, keen awareness. So getting your own therapy would be a very helpful tool, especially if there are specific areas that you need to really traverse to be able to be fully functioning. I mean, I guess you have to keep in mind that you can only give what you have, what you possess. So if you, for example, want to raise a child who has a healthy self-esteem, then you first have to have a healthy self-esteem. If you want your child to be able to assert him or herself, then you should be able to model that for them as well. You cannot expect them to have something that you really don't have.
Right. So you just need to get your own house straightened out on the inside and take care of yourself.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Or at least be in the process of, you know, getting on that journey to be able to make sure that whatever it is that you do not want to pass on, that you're able to dissolve within yourself. Otherwise, that's what's going to manifest.
Mm-hmm. And I think one thing, too, that somewhere down the road, somewhere within the journey of life, we all have to realize that our parents aren't perfect. I think just asking for a good enough parent and asking that of yourself is really important, because I think sometimes we can just judge ourselves and judge our own parents of, you know, why did you do this? Why did you make that mistake? Why didn't you think twice? Why didn't you? Why didn't you? And instead of looking and saying, thank you for doing A, B, and C, and I'm a pretty well-functioning person now, and, you know, I make mistakes also, but, you know, learn forgiveness for yourself as a parent and also for your own parents.
That's excellent advice, Julie. I think that really realizing that our parents did the very best they could with what they knew, with the resources that they had, and period, that's what they did, that's what they knew, and being able to move from there. Because once we get into the habit or the mindset of blaming our parents over and over again for things that we don't have, things that we've become, then we lose our power, we give it away. But once you're able to get hold of that and really come to realize that, okay, these things happened in my past, this is how I experienced them, this is the narrative that I've developed. However, you're also at a point in your life where you're cognizant enough, you're hopefully emotionally mature enough to be able to distinguish past from present. Otherwise, the negative past that you want to avoid, that you want to maybe even forget, will replicate itself in your relationship with your children.
Yes, exactly. That history that we don't look at and question will repeat itself.
Yes.
Yeah. Whether we like it or not.
Whether we like it or not. And Julie, I really like the point of forgiveness, because when you forgive someone, you're really freeing yourself, not the other person. You're freeing yourself of the power that that individual had on you. You're no longer angry. You're no longer resentful and bitter. And these are all negative energies. And if you have them, then that's what's going to come out of you as well, whether you're a parent, a wife, you know, a psychotherapist, whatever the case may be.
Right. And how typical is it to blame our parents for what we don't have?
Yes. And what we've become.
Yes. Very typical. So I guess the lesson is take back your own power, forgive, and just realize your parents did the best that they could for whatever means that they had or didn't have.
Yes.
Especially, you know, especially older parents. They didn't have all the trainings and the books and everything that's out now. I mean, there's so many guides to being a decent parent now.
And that's true.
You know, they just didn't have those books in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. So any of us who have older parents or grandparents even, you have to realize that they were just doing the best that they could. They were just passing down traditions from their own parents.
Exactly. And that in and of itself is very freeing.
It is, and that's what it's about, right? Just
Getting
rid of the baggage.
Yes, the healing process.
Yes, it is. So is there anything else about parenting that's important nowadays?
Well, not just nowadays, but I think the important thing about parenting is that it should be enjoyed. It's not just a matter of the disciplinary strategies and the useful tools and creating that perfect child. It's really enjoying who you have, the person that was, you know, given to you by life, and accentuating the positives, minimizing the negatives, and maybe even sublimating the negatives into something that's maybe more acceptable or more functional. I think each child is very unique. I mean, enough has probably been said about that. But really, looking into the child's eyes and enjoying the presence of the child. Because one day the child will leave your side. He or she will go off to college, get married, and, you know, have their own families. But when you have, what you have is only the present, and that's all you can enjoy, that's all you can really take in with you. And I think that truly the most important thing to remember as a parent is that the most critical thing that you can impart are your mores, your wisdom, your core beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
And that as they are lovable, they are acceptable, and because of this, they will gravitate toward other people, other situations, and life in general that will produce the same kind of atmosphere for them, that atmosphere of acceptance and unconditional love.
Yeah, that's the best to grow up in. And just to be able to enjoy them being little. It's so magical and so funny sometimes to see what little kids do.
Yes. And, you know, if you had a negative childhood, a, you know, poor upbringing, had so many unhappy experiences, this is your time to be able to recapture those moments with your child and re-experience it in a really different positive light.
Yes.
And being able to really enjoy it and being able to know maybe for the first time in your life what happiness really means, how it feels like.
Yeah, and just being able to be carefree and go out and play with your child.
Yes.
Is so fun. You know, when my son was little, we used to do just the funnest things together, and he still has the greatest laugh. His laugh brings me joy. And it's been consistent for 22 years, and it's just been a beautiful experience. And he's definitely been one of the strongholds and cores of the last 22 years of my life. He changed my life tremendously for the better.
That's wonderful to hear, Julie.
Yeah, and it just, but some of the crazy little things he used to do, just, you know, I take reverence in that and just take it in and let yourself be a little kid from time to time. Go out and play. Go do the Play-Doh. Go splash in some puddles and, you know, go run through the park. And it is really a freeing experience. just to let yourself go and play like that? Because I think as adults, so many of us just don't let ourselves have enough of that time. And we need it because we still have little kids inside of us who always need to have some kind of fun.
Absolutely. And that's the best kind of fun. And nothing on this planet is more fulfilling, Julie, than having that positive, happy relationship with your child.
Yes. Yes, it is. So, go ahead.
And it's a very sacred moment that you have with your children. Because once again, they grow up so, so fast. And before you know it, they're adults.
Yeah.
But everything that you've taught them, everything that you've integrated into their system, be assured that it's catalyzed and that it's crystallized and that it's there forever.
Yes.
Like a legacy that you've passed on.
Yeah, and it will be in their memory banks forever.
Yes, whether good or bad, but mostly good.
Yes, hopefully.
Hopefully.
Yeah, we want to add that in.
Yes,
and you can
definitely.
always correct, right? I mean,
yes.
If you had a bad childhood, you can correct it as an adult. And you can let pieces of it go.
Absolutely. I mean, again, you learn not just from the best, you learn from the worst, too.
And sometimes you learn more from the worst.
Yes, because you know what not to do.
Yes.
You know you know what to avoid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I think there's some internal, almost moral system within all of us that are saying, you know, this is right, this is wrong. Even when we're little, I think we can just kind of trigger when, that behavior is pretty embarrassing. Even when you're a little one, you can be like, I'm going to get away from this crazy adult.
There's something that's innate about it, isn't it? Shame and unacceptable behaviors, right?
Oh, yeah. We know it from early on.
Yes. So once again, if you want your child to have certain qualities, you need to first possess them first. Initially.
Yes.
Otherwise, it's not something that you can pass on if you don't have it.
Yeah, so take care of yourself first, just as you mentioned at the beginning of the show, Dr. Franco. Go take care of yourself. If you need a night out with your mate, go find a sitter. Go do that date night out. Go see a movie.
Make it a necessity, part of your routine even, self-care.
Yeah, even if it's, you know, when the kids are in bed, I'm going to go take a bath. I'm going to have a glass of wine with my husband or my wife. And let's just talk about things. And it doesn't have to be work and the kids, because I think a lot of couples end up just getting into, okay, they're into this routine and they're just trying so hard to keep everything in line that when they finally have time by themselves, they need to regain that intimacy and that love between them.
Absolutely right. Especially, Julie, during the first year of the child. Most parents are unable to detach themselves, even for a quick bite to eat.
Yeah, they are really encapsulated in becoming parents and the fears and joys and restless nights.
Yes. But forgetting, too, that being a happy couple would probably go farther than having both of you physically present 24 hours a day for the child. Having some time out, some time off, just as a couple would really largely positively impact, you know, your child's sense of well-being.
Yeah, and it also impacts them when they're adults and they start dating and they become intimately involved. Because it just, that gets so ingrained within a person's brain as to, well, my parents were or were not intimate in front of me, you know, hugging, kissing, just saying loving things to each other, you know, versus, you know, they said hello and goodbye and there was just no connection between them in front of the children. And that does impact how comfortable a person is when they're an adult with carrying on, you know, and just having that come naturally.
I agree with you that emotional atmosphere that we were talking about earlier, I think, really comes into play, especially in adult romantic relationships. You come to expect what you've seen, what you've witnessed, what you've experienced your entire life. So, you know, the saying that you marry your parent is really has credence in that regard.
Yes, it does. It's amazing once you start picking through that.
Yeah.
And people will start pointing out too, oh, my mother did that. Oh, my father did that. And that drove me crazy. And then you start seeing, oh, well, maybe that's why I was attracted to you in the first place.
Yes.
Right?
Exactly. Makes sense somehow.
Oddly
there is
enough.
A formula that exists.
Yes.
And it's not just random occurrences or choices.
Yes, it is. So, Dr. Franco, as we are wrapping up, are there any last thoughts about parenting?
Well, before you become a parent, do, again, you know, get your psychological needs met, your emotional needs met, and, of course, enjoy the present moment you have with your child. It's a sacred moment, as I said earlier, and it's something that is a gift to you. It can be pure magic or pure hell, mm-hmm. depending on how you look at it.
Yeah, how you behave, how you perceive your reality.
Exactly, yes.
And if the listeners would like to contact you, how can they do so?
They may contact me via email. That's Dr. M, DMFT, THEMFT at gmail.com. Or they may also give me a call at 562-212-7572. And I welcome their calls.
Well, thank you, Dr. Franco. It was a great show to open up 2015 with. I really appreciate you being on.
Thank you, Julianne. It's my pleasure. Thank you. And Happy New Year to you and your family.
Thank you. Happy New Year to you, too.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
And thank you so much for tuning in to Psych One-on-One. I am now running the show every other week, so I will be back in 2 weeks. And again, it is archived on iTunes Store under Psych One-on-One at SkidRowStudios.com. And you can also contact me at jgoode8 at Verizon.net. My office number is 562-234-4650, and I'm located down in Irvine, California. So if you'd like to contact me about anything, please do so. I would love to talk to you. I'd love to help you in any way that I can. I really appreciate you listening in. Have a great 2015. Make the most of your life. Take care of yourself. Take care of each other now.